A half moon was rising in the clear sky at the end of their second day in Hope. Kane, Grant, and Bridget had worked solidly through that first afternoon, organizing a temporary camp for the survivors of the quake and providing what little medical attention they could for the wounded. A lot of people had been shaken up, but there were only 9 reported deaths, mostly where the makeshift buildings had collapsed on people, although 2 more had drowned in the wave that had followed the quake. Kane had watched with growing admiration as the swordswoman, whose name was Rosalia, had turned her attention to first rescuing those people stuck in the water who had either never learned or were too panicked to swim, and then helping to entertain the lost children until their families could be found. Senor Smarts had offered help too once he had recovered from the pounding his body had taken when he had been thrown down the street astride the motorcycle. Initially, he had wandered the brackish streets in a daze, but when he had heard that people were getting organized at the robust church buildings, he had arrived at the door and asked how he might assist. Along with Bridget, Smarts had helped organize a reception system at the church hall where lost family members might be located. The steady stream of lost and weary people seemed never-ending, but finally, as the sun disappeared over the horizon for the second time since the quake, their numbers started to dwindle as people began making their way back to their ruined dwellings and thinking about picking up their lives again. While the church hall was quiet, Bridget peeled back the bandage that was wrapped around Smarts' head and took a proper look at the wound there.
Ooh, you took quite a beating.
She dabbed at the dried blood with a damp cloth while Grant looked on. Senor Smarts shot a fierce look at Grant.
I think your friend shot me, Bridget.
Grant looked apologetic.
Well.
Smarts held his gaze a moment longer before his expression mellowed a little.
What's done is done, senor. And I'm sure I had the intention to do the same, given the circumstances of our meeting.
Kane joined them as Bridget sterilized and dressed Smarts' head wound from the church's meager supplies.
Yeah, about that. What made you think that we were magistrates?
It's obvious. You and Senor Grant here have a certain manner about you, a way of walking, your heads held high, an air of authority, arrogance that comes only with the badge of office.
Kane smiled bitterly, shaking his head as Rosalia walked over to join the group, having finally found a family to take care of the last of her young charges.
I'm not a mag. None of us is a mag.
And the way the 3 of you took command here, organizing and taking care of the local people, tells me differently, senor. If you are not magistrates, then you almost certainly trained to be at some point in your past.
Grant flicked a warning look at Kane as if to tell him it wasn't a topic of conversation worth pursuing.
Any idea what happened to the rest of your crew? Where Karnak disappeared to?
I'm sorry, Senor Kane. I was unconscious for quite a while. When I realized what had happened, I felt it my duty to help out. That's all I can tell you.
Very admirable.
Grant stood up and took Kane to one side. They stood together, looking at the devastation outside the open church hall doors for a few moments.
This doesn't change anything. That hybrid DNA is still in the hands of their extended clan. We can't ignore that just because these 2 helped out.
No good deed goes unpunished.
You reckon the girl knows anything?
I'd guess Smarts is Karnak's second in command. If anyone knows the location of the gang and the DNA, he's the one. But Rosalia is more than she seems. I dismissed her as a companion when I first saw her. But the way she came at me with that sword yesterday afternoon, she's trained and she's deadly.
We'll take them both back to Cerberus. We can interrogate them there, see what we turn up.
He glanced back at the Mexican in the loud shirt and stained velvet coat, and at the dark-haired enchantress who stood beside him.
Who knows? Maybe they'll be more forthcoming after all that's happened.
I wouldn't bet on it.
As the 2 ex-mags walked back to where Bridget taped gauze to Senor Smarts' head, the contacts came to life.
Friend Kane, it seems that we may have an additional problem, and I wondered how the 3 of you would feel about taking a little detour to look into it.
Dr. Mohandas Lakesh Singh was the nominal leader of the Cerberus exiles, although his suitability to that role was somewhat contentious. His secret, single-handed rehabilitation of the Cerberus Redoubt was remarkable, but his rebellion against the Barons had been largely one of manipulation and misinformation until former magistrates Kane and Grant and archivist Bridget Baptiste had arrived. Once exiled from Cobaltville, Kane, Grant, and Bridget had been shown that working with the accomplished cyberneticist would afford them an opportunity to oppose the Barons and undermine the tyranny under which they had all been raised. With nowhere else to go, they allied themselves with Lakesh and advanced the rebellion, becoming the enforcement arm of the underground movement headquartered at the Cerberus Redoubt and carrying out the missions that Lakesh alone devised. Their later discovery that it was Lakesh's own Machiavellian plan to destroy their lives in Koboldville, albeit for the greater good, had shifted the balance of power within the group. When confronted with the evidence of his own deviousness, Lakesh had no choice but to concede that his single-minded control of Cerberus and its exiles undermined the united front necessary to battle the Anunnaki, the hybrid barons, and the threat they posed to humankind. He had then grudgingly agreed to a slightly more democratic approach to decision-making, an arrangement with which he was never quite comfortable.
Lakesh, what seems to be the problem?
Descartes has just got in touch with us from Aten. He stumbled across something on one of his regular patrols, and he thinks we might want to take a look.
Descartes, like Kanan Grant, was also an ex-magistrate. He had been adopted into the strange culture of the hidden city kingdom of Aten, out in the wilderness of the California desert. His path had crossed that of the Cerberus crew on several occasions. Initially hostile, the people of Aten had come to respect the Cerberus exiles, and Descartes had proved himself to be a faithful friend and valuable ally.
Did Descartes say what it was?
He seemed mystified, but the report he gave describes a group of people who apparently have no independent will. He called them mindless, soulless wretches.
I don't want to be callous here, but is that such a big deal?
It is, when the same people were vibrant and very much alive just 3 days earlier, or so Descartes indicates.
Okay, we'll arrange transportation and get over there before dawn. Warn Descartes that we're bringing a couple of stragglers with us, and we might need to use his hooscow.
I'm sending Domi over there now via Mattrans. She'll pass on the message and meet you close to Aten. Take care.
Will do, Lakesh.
Kane turned to the others, who had been able to hear the whole conversation on their own contacts.
Well, troops, looks like we're moving out.
Senor Smarts, who had only heard Kane's half of the conversation, smiled tightly.
Leaving so soon?
Yeah. And you're coming with us, Smarts.
Kane looked across at Rosalia, the dancing girl, and smiled.
You too, princess.
The five of them skulked through the alleyways of Hope, hidden in the shadows of the ruined ville. Kane walked close to Senor Smarts, leading the party, the magnum handgun held tightly in his hand. Behind him, Grant accompanied Rosalia, pulling her by the elbow, his own pistol hidden under the folds of his leather duster. Bridget brought up the rear, a few paces behind the rest of the group, her handgun drawn and held low, muzzle pointing to the ground. As they made their way to the outskirts of the shantytown, Rosalia's eyes flashed with anger. She pulled from Grant's grip and strode ahead, catching up with Smarts and Kane.
Where are you taking us, Magistrate Man?
We're needed elsewhere.
Grant reached for the woman's elbow once more.
Ugh!
Rosalia glared fiercely at them both, standing in place until Bridget caught up.
After all we have done for you, you still treat us like criminals?
Look, we need that hybrid DNA, and right now, the two of you are our only link to finding it.
We all have a lot of admiration for what you both did back there. You stepped in to help when it was needed. We don't need to be enemies. Perhaps we can reach a mutually beneficial agreement with regards to the DNA.
Well, this puts us in a difficult position, Señorita. It would be inadvisable for Rosalia and myself to engage in dealings that might be considered traitorous to our group.
Would that still hold true outside of Ville limits?
Smarts considered this as Rosalia's dark eyes scanned the alleyway in a predatory fashion.
Perhaps we would reconsider our position if placed in such a situation.
Then let's keep moving.
And where exactly is it that we are going, Señor Kane?
Just a little walk in the desert. Friends out there need our help, but you can just watch if you want.
Rosalia looked at the half-moon rising in the sky.
It is almost midnight, Magistrate Man. Not a good time to be walking across the desert.
It's mighty cold out there.
Along with his companions, Kane had arrived in Hope from the desert. The three of them had used the interphaser to jump close to the Ville location, but they had still been forced to walk the last 8 miles for the sake of appearances as much as anything else. That had been in the daytime in the rising heat. At night, the temperature in the California desert dropped significantly, and the chill wind could catch a traveler unawares.
There's never a good time to cross the desert. Hence, the argument's over.
I think not. We could borrow a vehicle from one of the people here without too much trouble.
By borrow, you mean steal? We don't do that.
Señor Magistrate, many people here have lost their homes, their loved ones, some even their lives. The loss of a cart, an automobile, will be a little weight.
Doesn't matter. You have legs, so we walk.
We have reconditioned sand cats, ideal for desert travel.
And where would these sand cats be?
Back at the base. If we went there, we could pick them up.
No. Nice try. But we won't be walking into any traps tonight. Now, let's get moving.
Kane and Grant urged their charges on as Brigid sank back to cover the rear of the party. What Kane hadn't told Smarts and Rosalia was that he had his own special transport located outside the ville. They weren't safe here, and he had feared being overheard, but soon enough the group would be traveling a whole lot faster than the two street thieves could imagine. It was 3 a.m. by the time the group stopped. The ville was long since behind them, now just a speckling of lighted dots on the far horizon. Ahead and all around, Death Valley and the empty California desert stretched relentlessly onward. Stars twinkled in the night sky, and the cool air seemed to drill through their bones as the group strode across the open sand. Rosalia shook, cold and miserable, hugging herself as she pulled Smarts' bright frock coat over her shoulders. Smarts himself was cold, too, but he prided himself on being nothing if not a gentleman.
Where are we heading, senor?
We're almost there.
It has been a long day. We could stop, if not for ourselves. Perhaps we should consider the ladies.
We're not going much farther. Baptiste?
Brigid had drifted a little farther behind the others, and she was looking around carefully as they crossed the bleak desert.
It's just over there!
She pointed with the muzzle of her handgun toward a rising sand dune.
It'll be a minute, people.
Exhausted, Rosalia sat on the dry sand and shook her head.
Magistrate clowns.
Grant smiled and caught her eye, shaking his own head in chastisement.
Oh, you are in for such a sweet surprise.
Smart's head twitched like a bird's as he watched Brigid disappear behind the dune.
What is going on?
It's time we traveled in style.
Smarts narrowed his eyes, peering at the dune, his head jutting forward until Brigid reappeared carrying a small case. The case was caked with sand, which Brigid brushed away with her hand as she approached. Smarts realized immediately that this item had been hidden out here, buried somewhere in the empty, featureless desert. Brigid stopped before them and knelt, placing the case on the ground. Then she began to work at its twin catches. Soon a squat, broad-based pyramid-shaped object was revealed. Made of a dull metal that shimmered with the blurred reflections of the bright stars, the pyramid's base was barely 1 foot square, and its peak was about 12 inches above the ground. This was the interphaser.
What is this thing?
A little shortcut.
You left this thing here, yes? How could you possibly find it? It is a, a needle in a haystack.
Brigid's our needle finder.
Smarts looked baffled as he assessed the beautiful woman with the shimmering red-gold hair. Brigid smiled and tapped the side of her head.
I remember things.
The Cerberus team had opted to bury the interphaser in its protective carrying case close to where they had first appeared in the desert. This was, on reflection, much safer than carrying the astonishing piece of technology into a covert meeting with Karnak's merciless thieves and brigands. They had needed no marker for the location. One of the advantages of Brigid's phenomenal memory was her ability to recall the smallest details of anything she had seen. While the desert appeared featureless and largely unchanging to most people, Brigid would recall the tiniest details, a ridge here, a dead tree stump there. Finding the burial spot for this particular treasure chest was as easy to Brigid as finding the toes on the end of her feet. The interphaser interacted with naturally occurring hyperdimensional vortices to create an instantaneous teleportation system. In simple terms, the little pyramid opened dimensional rifts through which one could travel from point A to point B, despite the 2 points being dozens, hundreds, or even thousands of miles apart. The Parallax Points program provided a map of these naturally occurring vortices, which could be found around the world and even on other planets. The success of the interphaser was the combined work of Brigid Baptiste and a Cerberus scientist called Brewster Filboid, and had taken many months of trial and error to achieve. While a useful device, their interphaser still depended on the location of a Parallax Point, as opposed to the MATTRANS units, which had been installed in military redoubts. While Brigid readied the pyramid-shaped device, Kane probed the sand around them with the toe of his boot until he found what he was looking for. He uncovered a flat stone disc. The stone disc was approximately 2 feet across and showed cuneiform carvings around its outer ring. Brigid stepped across and carefully placed the interphaser unit in the center of the stone ring.
What is that?
We think it was some kind of grave marker, probably Navajo or Apache.
Or whatever those peoples called themselves way back when.
Rosalia took a step closer and peered at the stone circle with the pyramid now protruding from it. Then she looked at Smarts, a quizzical frown on her beautiful brow.
What is all this?
I admit to being mystified. Seems the magistrates don't want to share their secrets today.
Okay, here's the skinny. What we have here is a transport network like you folks can only dream of. The whole thing is instantaneous.
Like a Matrans, only portable.
You've used a Matrans?
The Matrans units were mostly the realm of Cerberus and similar covert outfits who had penetrated the secret military redoubts to access the hidden technology there. Their existence was hardly common knowledge.
I have seen them in action once or twice.
Good. That makes it easier for all of us. Rosie?
I am aware of the Matrans machines, though only through anecdotal evidence.
These are smaller, and there's no chamber to enter, but they function in much the same way.
He encouraged the pair to step forward, closer to the foot-high pyramid resting on the stone circle on the ground. The stone circle was a parallax point and would work as a secure entry point for their jump. Grant stepped across from the others so that the team now formed a rough circle around the interphaser as the stars twinkled in the sky above. Still kneeling, Bridget tapped out a brief sequence on the interphaser's miniature keypad. As she stood, a waxy, illuminated cone of light fanned up from the metal apex of the foot-high pyramid. It had the appearance of mist, with flashes of light swirling within its depths. Smarts' jaw opened in astonishment as the cone of light grew larger, taking over not just more geographical space, but in some way swamping his mind like the onrush of a migraine, blurring everything around him to insignificance as it overwhelmed his comprehension. A glowing lotus flower blossomed from the base of the pyramid. The radiance stretched into the night sky, filled with sparks of lightning like witchfire.
Just walk into the light.
Smarts turned from the cone of brilliance to look at the hard face of the ex-mag. The light was dancing in Kane's gray-blue eyes, playing across the stubbled chin and sharp planes of his face.
I don't think this is such a good idea, Senor Kane.
Then Grant's bear-like arm whipped behind Smarts.
Man up, Smarts. You're going first.
The colors were so bright and vibrant that Smarts didn't have names for all of them. And then his senses rebelled at the unfamiliarity of the situation. And the next thing Smarts saw was his shadow grow as he stepped out of the cone of light behind him. They had arrived.
Did we do it?
60, 70 miles in a footstep. We did it.
68 miles.
Bridget crouched beside the device, which now rested on an otherwise unremarkable section of sand, and placed the carrying case beside it, undoing the catches. There was another circle of stone there, almost entirely buried in the sand, its cuneiform markings long since worn away. Having packed up the interphaser in its carrying case, Bridget scanned the sky around them, looking at the constellations and assessing their position in her head. Kane triggered the contact.
Domi, we're on site. Please respond.
Hi, Kane. I'm with Descartes' team. We're sending up a tracer on three.
Otten should be somewhere over that way.
Bridget pointed off to the east. They then saw a scarlet-colored firework rise in the sky, leaving a bright point high over their heads as the flare beacon floated on the wind currents.
Guess that's them.
It took another 15 minutes to cover the ground on foot, but Kane, Bridget, Grant, and their two prisoners finally found their way to the temporary campsite that Descartes' crew had set up among the windswept dunes. When she saw them approaching, Domi broke into a run and met the Cerberus team halfway.
Madre de Dios!
Though a fully grown woman, Domi still had the diminutive size of a girl just entering her teens, yet she was a superb athlete and robust hand-to-hand combatant. Most significantly, however, Domi looked like no one else that Smarts had ever seen. She had the chalk-white skin and bone-white hair of an albino, and her eyes blazed a burning ruby red like the flames of hell. She wore her hair in a short, pixie-ish style, and she had chosen the briefest of clothes, a halter top and cut-off shorts, leaving her midriff, limbs, and feet bare. Her clothing was beige, matching the sandy desert beneath the dark sky, its light color making her white skin seem somehow more pale than ever. Like the other members of Kane's field team, Cobaltville played a prominent part in Domi's past. Domi had been forced into sexual servitude in the lowest echelons of the Ville. She had grown up as a wild child of the Outlands, and her wits and decision-making still had something of the instinctive to them.
Kane!
Domi wrapped her arms around him. Kane hugged her back, looking like a giant holding a tiny China doll.
I heard you ran into that quake over on the coast. You're okay?
I think that quake really ran into us.
Kane and Domi had a strange history between them, but above all else, they were bound by a mutual respect as warriors.
Brought some friends for you to meet.
Kane gestured to Senor Smarts and Rosalia, who stood beside Grant. her jaw jutting at a haughty angle as she observed the albino woman.
"This is Rosalia, and the gentleman is called Smarts."
Smarts took Domi's hand, bringing it to his lips.
"Enchanted, señorita."
After the introductions had been made, the group headed back to the camp where Descartes and his team were stationed. It was a simple affair, just a bivouac created from a couple of sheets of tarpaulin, propped over a small area atop posts pushed into the sand. Once he was close enough, Kane recognized the posts that Descartes' crew had used. They were the slender silver rods that the security force of Aten used as their primary weapons. The long poles were tipped by V-shaped prongs, and they were capable of unleashing a discharge of energy that could fell a man, knocking him into unconsciousness or worse, depending upon the setting employed by the user. The makeshift nature of the camp reminded Kane of the shanty town that they had just left on the outskirts of Hope. Two armed guards nodded in acknowledgement as Domi approached, leading the group to the tent. The guards were incarnates, and both came from similar stock. They were sturdy-looking individuals, their skin a shining coffee-bean brown from the sun. Their clothing was identical, naked but for loosely woven white linen kilts threaded with golden wire, coupled with glittering collars of hammered gold that embraced their necks. The only thing to differentiate them were the unique adornments on their faces. Both men wore masks that entirely covered their heads, remarkable helmets carved of painted and varnished wood. The mask of the Sekhman on the left bore a fierce caricature of a crocodile, its long snout pointing down to the ground, its rows of teeth highlighted in white paint. The man to the right wore the mask of a bug, an idealized version of a beetle, with large eyes and pincers that resembled the drooping lines of Grant's gunslinger mustache. As Domi led the way into the small makeshift shelter, Descartes got up from his resting position on the floor. The tent was lit by three small oil-burning lamps that had been placed around the floor space. There were more guards inside, eight in all, and several had removed their helms and were dozing. Descartes was a fresh-faced young man in his 20s, with close-cropped sandy blonde hair. He wore the armor of a magistrate, a familiar black polycarbonate exoskeleton, and it added a sense of authority to his 5-foot-10-inch frame. Both Smarts and Rosalia backed away when they saw the mag armor, but Grant was standing behind them.
Oh!
Nothing to get worked up about.
On closer inspection, they saw that the magistrate armor was lacking the red insignia that usually graced the left pectoral. It looked to have been torn from the outfit. Descartes himself bore a friendly expression as he walked across the tent to meet with his old comrades.
Hello, Kane. Glad you could all make it out here.
What's going on, Descartes?
I was on patrol 3 days ago when I came across a group of roamers. Just a family of refugees, I think, crossing the desert. They'd set up camp quite close to the city entrance, and I brought some men out here to shoo them away.
Descartes looked at Kane as though hoping for approval. Kane understood what the man meant. Descartes, like himself and Grant, may have retired prematurely, but he still had the old magistrate instincts. In Descartes' case, he had been accidentally caught up in a conspiracy involving the welfare of new hybrids, and had somehow found himself on the run. He had landed on his feet in the hidden city kingdom of Aten, California, where he had gone native and married into royalty. Descartes had found a better life than most magistrates, and his world was generally far more sedate than that of Kane or Grant. Aten treasured its secrecy, a community hidden away from the harsh realities of the world, and Descartes had become the de facto leader of the incarnates, the guardians of the city. He still made patrols around the city kingdom, though he used his skills as a diplomat far more often than his handgun these days. Kane nodded, encouraging the man to continue.
I was doing a surveillance sweep around dusk when I came across one of the same folks. Only this time she looked like this.
Descartes gestured to a figure crouching on the ground behind two standing helmeted guards. As the guards parted, Kane saw a young woman with long blonde hair, probably still in her teenage years, bearing the swollen belly of pregnancy. Her hair was damp with sweat, curtained over her eyes, and she rocked back and forth on her heels, her jaw slack. Drool oozed down her chin from her open mouth. As Kane stepped closer, he felt something nudge him and saw that Descartes was handing him a flashlight.
Go on, she won't bite.
Kane pointed the flashlight away from the woman before turning it gradually to illuminate her clearly. She just crouched there, rocking back and forth, not reacting in the slightest to his approach.
Are you okay, ma'am?
The woman seemed to be ignoring him. She just rocked back and forth repeatedly. Kane reached forward with his free hand as if to tentatively touch the woman's face. She didn't flinch, didn't move at all. And before Kane's fingers met her skin, he turned back to Descartes.
Do I need gloves?
Hell if I know.
Deckard shook off one of his gloves and passed it to Kane.
Use this if you want.
Kane took the mag gauntlet and pulled it over his right hand before reaching for the young woman again. Crouching before her, Kane used the black fingers of the glove to smooth her hair gently away from where it had obscured her face. Beneath her mop of hair, as he had somehow suspected, her eyes were wide open. They were blank, pure white orbs. White on white, all color drained away. Kane turned away from the woman, letting her blonde bangs fall back over her face.
Do you know what's going on with her, Deckard?
No idea. I've never seen anything like this before. She's running a high temperature, just like the others we found.
There are others?
There were eight in the original party that we chased off, and we found three of them running around out here at dusk. I say running, but I don't mean that literally, of course.
Mindless, soulless wretches. Isn't that what you said?
It wasn't intended as a medical diagnosis, but it was about the best way I could think of to describe them.
Brigid Baptiste placed her polymer gloves over her hands. They were disposable, transparent, and reached just past her wrists. Then she crouched before the pregnant woman.
What about the others, Deckard?
What you see here is a pretty accurate picture of how they were. We found the three of them wandering about the desert here, aimless as leaves on the wind, just walking around in circles. I think they're a family, or at least they were.
Where are the others now?
Deckard placed a hand on Kane's shoulder and pulled him toward the closest opening of the bivouac.
Let's talk about that outside.
Leaving Grant, Domi, and the Incarnates to watch their prisoners, Kane and Deckard stood outside the tent, waiting for Brigid to join them.
Her temperature's running at 105 and rising. She must be burning up inside.
Not burning. Melting. Can a body even take that kind of temperature?
The human body can take greater extremes than we give it credit for, but I don't like her long-term chances, especially with the baby.
The other two went like that. First, they were walking about like they'd been concussed. Then they sat down, mumbling and drooling.
And then?
Now they're dead, Kane.
Shit. What have you stumbled on here?
We're 4 miles from Aten. Far as I'm concerned, this is the very limit of my jurisdiction. I called Cerberus in because I don't have the time or resources to deal with it. Figured maybe you do.
That's mighty brave of you.
We look after our own, Kane. That's the rule of the Outlands, and you know it. These freaks get closer to the city, and I'll do what I have to. But I'm in way over my head here.
What if it's a plague, an airborne virus? Something you can't just pretend doesn't exist. What then?
Deckard paced across the sand for a moment, head low, absorbed by his thoughts.
I've got 4 people and 2 prisoners. We need manpower, and your people are on the scene, Deckard. Will you help us?
None of this can be brought back to the city. No prisoners. None of the infected. I am not having this spread through Aten.
None of us wants that.
I'm out here with a 12-man team. You get me and them, and that's it, okay?
You just keep your gun loaded.
Don't worry. We'll find out what it is. No one else needs to get hurt.
Back inside the bivouac, Rosalia was peering at the far end of the tent, watching the pregnant woman rocking back and forth on her heels.
What is wrong with that lady?
That's what we're here to find out. Friends of ours found her wandering the desert. Figured we'd be able to help.
And what is it that you do?
Domi flashed smarts a feral smile.
Me? I do surgery.
She produced a very dangerous-looking knife with a 9-inch serrated blade.
Want a nose job? Let me tell you how I got this knife.
Domi.
Oh, that reminds me.
Leaving Grant with the prisoners, she made her way to a small tan-colored rucksack on one side of the tent. She returned with a sin-eater handgun and a forearm holster.
Thought you might need this. Brought one for Kane, too.
Grant shrugged out of the right sleeve of his coat and slipped the wrist holster to his right forearm. The sin-eater was the official sidearm of the Magistrate Division and the weapon with which Grant and Kane felt most comfortable. Less than 14 inches in length at full extension, the automatic hand blaster folded in on itself to be stored in the bulky holster just above the wrist. The holsters reacted to a specific tensing of the wrist tendons, snapping the pistol automatically into the user's hand. The trigger of the Sin Eater had no guard. The necessity for any kind of safety features had never been foreseen when the weapon had been assigned to the infallible magistrates. While both Grant and Kane were schooled in numerous forms of unarmed and armed combat, the Sin-Eater was an old friend, a natural weight that their movements accommodated, like wearing a wristwatch.
I said you were magistrates, did I not, senor?
Why don't you help yourselves out here, smarts, and give us the information we want about the hybrid DNA? You can see that you're nothing more than dead weight to us right now. You give us the info, and we'll let you walk out of here, no questions asked.
I will need to discuss this with my colleague. You understand?
Discuss away.
In private, if you would be so kind.
Grant gestured to the open doorway of the tent covering.
Let's go outside.
Smarts and Rosalia led the way into the cool night air, with Grant and Domi following. They made their way past the guards, and Grant stopped. He indicated vaguely in the direction ahead, where a few dried-up bushes dotted the sand.
Take 10 paces off in that direction and have your discussion. I'll be right here.
Me too!
Domi held a Detonix 45 pistol with a chrome finish. Smarts bowed subtly to Grant, then turned. The pair of brigands stopped after trying to create as much distance as possible from their captors without stoking their ire.
We need to get out of here.
Not yet. You saw the device they used, the portable Matrans unit.
Of course.
Such a device would be of inestimable value to our people.
It would doubtless sell for a pretty penny. A very pretty, shiny penny indeed.
Forget your magpie instincts. With that unit, we could go anywhere, take anything. We could be the new masters of the world.
You're a fool. You overestimate its value to Tom.
A gateway to anywhere on the planet, arriving and departing without warning or preamble. I think not. You saw the case in which the woman put it? She has it with her. We must steal that case before we depart. Can you do this, sweet Rose?
Smarts pulled a pocket cron with a thin metal chain from his pants pocket.
That will not be a problem, if the right opportunity presents itself.
They are busy worrying about the sick woman with no sight. We are no longer their primary concern. They'll let their guard down soon enough, I am sure of it.
The plastic face of the pocket cron had misted up where water had been caught inside it during the tidal wave in Hope. The front was still blurred.
And in the meantime, they will keep pestering us for the information about the hidden base.
Let them pester.
Smarts checked the cron carefully. Though disguised as an old-fashioned fob watch, the item that Smarts had produced from his pocket wasn't simply that. It was, in fact, a compass with electronic rangefinder. Smarts looked at the spinning needle that appeared to be a loose minute hand for a moment, before glancing back at their captors to reassure himself that neither Grant nor Domi was taking any notice. They weren't. With Rosalia still standing before him, Smarts replaced the compass in his pocket.
A little sleight of hand, the illusion of progress. They'll soon get bored and sloppy.
The dark-skinned one is like a wall, impenetrable. But Cain is a soft touch. He lets his emotions rule him.
I think you like him.
He has a certain way about him, but a knife still fits between his ribs.
As Smarts and Rosalia were talking between themselves, Domi turned and nudged Grant.
Do you trust them?
They're a pair of brigands who deal in stolen genetic material. What's not to trust?
Touché.
Bridget removed the electric thermometer from the mouth of the pregnant woman and read it.
106 and still climbing.
Bridget looked at the sheen of sweat that covered the pregnant woman's face and made her clothes dark. The woman's humming had stopped some time ago. Her rocking had slowed, and now she was lying on the floor of the tent.
What can we do to cool her down?
I don't think there's anything.
What about going outside the tent? No cloud cover. That desert wind. It's pretty damn chilly out there.
No, that won't work. This is something inside her, something eating away at her.
The baby?
I don't think so.
Then what about...
The baby's dead, Cain. Whatever trauma her body's going through here, the infant has experienced it 10 times worse. Horrible as it is, we have to face facts.
Cain looked at the girl as she shook in place.
We could call in Reba DeFore.
DeFore was the Cerberus healer, tasked to care for every member of the redoubt staff. In her time with Cerberus, she had dealt capably with hybrid and alien physiology, as well as the human body.
I suspect there's nothing Reba could do, even if she were here. I'm sorry, Cain.
We could still save the baby.
No, Cain.
We can try.
Bridget caught and held his gaze with her own.
Cain, it's too late.
20 minutes later, the young woman and her unborn child were dead. She had moaned and shook violently for a brief period. Less than half a minute in all, and a trickle of blood had oozed momentarily from her left ear. Her eyes became a viscous goo as they melted from their sockets. Descartes' men placed a sheet over the victim's body.
Do you think she was in much pain, Bridget?
I don't think she felt anything. I don't think she even knew who she was in the end.
Would you like to examine the body?
Just bury her.
Once the body had been given a shallow grave and the prisoners placed under armed guard, Grant found Cain standing a little way from the bivouac, gazing off into the heavens.
You okay, Cain?
That's the desert. Clearest skies you ever did see. I'm fine.
The girl?
It's not the girl. At least it's not just the girl. I mean, that's a terrible thing to happen, especially to an unborn child like that, but it's not that.
Grant looked up at the sky again, following Kane's gaze.
Wasn't so long ago that we were up there, fighting aliens and causing a ruckus.
Yeah. And it's the ruckus that bothers me. Where are the Anunnaki? We're down here chasing around after hybrid DNA and the latest strain of fever, and we've not heard zip from the overlords.
The Anunnaki were an alien race who had evolved through the genetic manipulation of the Nine Barons, who had controlled mainland America in the early years of the 23rd century. The Anunnaki were a bored alien race who had first appeared on Earth many millennia before. Their saga was literally the stuff of legend. They had subjugated humankind and had been revered as gods by the earliest of humanity's cultures. But in reality, the Anunnaki were little more than a technically superior race of bored, cruel monsters who enjoyed playing with the primitive creatures that they found on the Earth. A division within the ranks of the Anunnaki themselves had brought about the near destruction of humankind when the aliens unleashed the catastrophe that the Bible recounted in the tale of the Great Flood. The flood was intended by Enlil, prince of the Anunnaki, to wash away the remnants of the primitive playthings that dotted the Earth like a rash. Later, Enlil had discovered that tenacious humanity had survived, with a little help from the dissenters within the ranks of the Anunnaki themselves, led by his own brother, Enki. Enlil's purge had been unsuccessful, and amused by the survival of his playthings, Enlil and his fellow Anunnaki had devised whole new ways to manipulate their enduring, rebellious toys. Nobody could really say how long the Anunnaki had shaped world events, but it was understood that they had orchestrated the second great cataclysm in the form of the nuclear war that had devastated the planet in January 2001. The new cost had culled the human population and allowed for the emergence of the new ruling elite called the Barons, whose DNA Tom Karnak's people had claimed to be holding. The baronial elite were merely a chrysalis form for the Anunnaki, however, and a download from the organic computer in the starship Tiamat, stationed in orbit around the Earth, had regenerated the godlike Anunnaki pantheon from their shells. The Cerberus warriors had spent much of the past few years battling with Enlil and the other reptilian Anunnaki, and every victory was bittersweet. As Kane reasoned, any file download could be opened and accessed again. Defeat one Anunnaki and another could appear in its place. As such, any lull in the ongoing war felt like nothing more than a temporary reprieve.
There's an old saying, Kane. Make hay while the sun shines.
I prefer the other one about the calm before the storm.
Kane turned and paced back to the camp, with Grant at his side.
Pack your waterproofs, partner. We're in for a shitstorm.
Descartes and Kane sat together in the tent. Besides four incarnates left standing guard, everyone in the group was asleep, catching a few hours of rest before sunrise.
What's the story with your two friends, Kane?
They're a pair of street thieves.
Seems a bit low rent for you, Kane. They must have stolen something real big.
Word from the rumor mill has it that they're holding hybrid DNA out of Beausoleil, along with the means to reproduce little barons from it. We leave crap like that unchecked, and suddenly we've got a whole new spate of the tyrannical bastards cropping up to push people around like pawns on a chessboard.
Have you seen this genetic material?
It's all just rumor, but their leader spun a pretty good yarn.
These people always talk big, trying to jack up the price for something that turns out to be a whole load of nothing.
Throw enough bait and you get your fish, right? Still, Lakish didn't want it going unchecked.
Which one's the leader?
We lost him. Got caught up in an earthquake out on the coast. Guy called Tom Karnak escaped during the confusion.
Yeah, we felt it in Aten, too.
Baptiste figures it shook the whole fault line. Spoke to Cerberus yesterday. Mariah thinks it went as far as Arizona.
That's one monster quake.
It's not unknown around here.
Descartes glanced across the sleeping prisoners where they lay, their hands cuffed in the middle of the bivouac.
So what about these two? You have something in mind?
Just got caught up in the moment. Priorities went haywire during the earthquake. Seemed the prudent thing to do was bring them with us and interrogate them when we get back to Cerberus. Otherwise, we'd have likely lost the trading gang for good.
Are they dangerous?
Don't know about the guy. Doesn't seem much of a fighter, but he thinks quick. Had me and Grant pegged for mags as soon as he saw us. The chica's a different story. Seems pretty enough till you put a knife in her hand. Cut you as soon as look at you.
Just knives?
Knives, swords. I figure she knows her way around anything with a sharp edge. Haven't seen her use a gun, but I wouldn't be surprised if she can hit a target at 50 paces.
You always did keep exciting company, Kane.
Keep an eye on them and tell your men to do the same. If we're not careful, they'll turn into trouble.
We're in the middle of the desert. Where are they going to go?
They're survivors, Deckard. Maybe you've been living in Aten too long to remember what that's like.
I'll keep my eyes open.
With the arrival of dawn came two more incarnates, riding one of the strange motorized chariot-like vehicles that Aten produced for its people. Dressed as the other men in white kilts and gold neck braces, these two wore the carved masks of a hawk and ibis. They had been scouting the area while the rest of the group rested, and now they returned to bring their morning report to Deckard. Ibis removed his mask to reveal a hard-looking face with a haughty, imperious aspect to his lantern jaw and a nasty scar just above his left eye.
We have found the rest of the roamers.
Bridget and Kane came to join Deckard at the entrance of the bivouac.
There, off to the east. There's evidence of a campfire and their wags remain intact. We followed the tracks and found all five of them about a mile further on from the fire. They were lying in the sand, and there were signs of a scuffle. Sand had been kicked up.
Any clue what did this?
Ibis looked at Kane fiercely until Deckard signaled that he could speak freely to the man.
There are more tracks out there. Something big.
Any idea what? A sand cat, maybe?
They weren't clear, but they looked like footprints. A little haphazard. We followed them for a while, but nothing came of it.
What, you quit or you lost them?
We made a strategic decision that the distance was becoming too far from Aten to pose a threat.
Which is to say that you thought you were wasting your time.
My orders are to protect the city kingdom, though I don't see that it's any business of yours.
Ibis took a step toward Kane, who failed to be intimidated, and stood firm. Across the tent, Smarts' head lifted. A slight smile creased his thin lips. Deckard held his outstretched arms between Ibis and Kane, making them step back from each other.
I called Kane's team in, and he will benefit from knowing all of the facts.
Kane shrugged and put on a gleeful, innocent expression.
Just following orders, same as you.
Deckard, we need to look at the site, examine the bodies, see where those tracks lead.
Agreed. We have some dried fruit with us. Let's say we have breakfast, then move out in an hour.
Sounds civilized.
Kane made his way across the floor of the tent. Crouching beside Domi's rucksack, Kane attached the spare sin-eater and wrist holster that his albino colleague had brought him.
1 hour.
The campsite was much as the Incarnate Guard had described it. The ashy remains of a fire pit in the sand, two wagons that had been left untended, disturbed sand here and there that obliquely suggested some frantic movement. The Cerberus field team and their prisoners traveled to the site using the chariot-like vehicles that the Incarnates drove. There were 10 of the vehicles in all, large enough to carry 2 men comfortably, 4 if they didn't mind being cramped. The chariots were carts with 2 large wheels on a single axle and no visible means of locomotion. Using an array of mirrored panels, the 2-wheeled vehicles converted solar power into electricity and could run indefinitely as long as they had a charge. Elegant and functional, while the chariots traveled at a fairly low speed, they made the journey across the great swaths of desert that much more palatable. Kane had considered it most prudent to split the prisoners on the journey to the campsite, and he sat in one of the little buggies talking with Smarts, while Grant sat with Rosalia on the back of another chariot, while the Incarnates ferried them across the sand.
This is kidnapping, Senor Kane. It seems a little beneath a magistrate like yourself.
Things have moved a bit faster than I'd have preferred, Smarts, but you can get yourself free passage as soon as you're ready to hand over the hybrid DNA.
Which I don't have on me, so your offer is worthless.
Where's it being kept? You've got to know that much, right?
Smarts smiled enigmatically. Kane glanced at the clear blue sky overhead as the flotilla of chariots progressed across the dunes. Then he turned back to Smarts.
Look, neither of us is in a great negotiating position here. But I am not going to let you or the girl go until I have a decent lead on the location.
So, we are stuck together.
I'm willing to make you an offer, Senor Smarts. Safe passage, a vehicle, whatever it is you need. We can negotiate the details, and I'll be as amenable as possible. I need this information, and you have it. You think about what it is you want, and we'll go from there, okay?
You are a generous man, perhaps.
This barren DNA could be a lot of trouble. Not just for me. We get a whole new spate of baronies growing up, and operations like yours will be seized upon in an instant. You'll all be thrown in the Tartarus pits. Karnak should have taken up my colleague's offer when he had the chance. you'd have all been rich men right now.
Is that so, Signor Magistrate?
Figure out a way to make this work before I get impatient.
The group of chariots pulled to a stop a short distance from two parked wagons and the remains of the campfire, and the Cerberus personnel disembarked to take a closer look, leaving the incarnates guarding their prisoners. Bridget and Kane walked over to examine the wagons, while Grant studied the ash of the fire, trying to find anything peculiar. Domi stood with Descartes by the parked chariots, a little way from the main camp, her eyes on the two prisoners, while Descartes' incarnates patrolled the surrounding area. The wagons were old-fashioned carts pulled by a raggedy mule and a tired horse with bowed legs and a swollen belly that sagged almost to the ground. The animals seemed bored, although Kane could see where the horse had become tangled in its reins, probably at the appearance of whatever disrupted the roamers. The wagons were covered by simple canvas sheets, uncolored but dirty-looking from age and travels. Kane pointed to one of the coverings that had a rent across it, running the whole length of the mule's wagon.
That looks new.
Bridget nodded. Roamers were used to making do, and they would repair such a tear immediately, even if the fabric they used was a poor match.
Reckon it has something to do with this?
Bridget took a closer look, pulling at the torn material, examining the length of the rip.
Hard to say for certain. Are you thinking the roamers did this themselves in a fit of madness, or that something attacked them? Because that depends on whether this is some airborne plague or something else.
Well, little Miss Mom-to-be back there wasn't in much of a ripping cloth mood by the time we saw her.
Descartes said that his men came across her and the others just wandering aimlessly, remember? Could have had a flurry of activity before they reached the state of catatonia that resulted in death.
A lot of coulds.
Be a few more before we're done.
As they looked around, Grant came over to join them.
You guys need any help?
No, there's nothing here.
Same story with the ash.
Bridget glanced up at the sun, a colorless orb in the sky out here in the desert. She stepped from the back of the wagon and into its fierce light once more.
I guess we go look at the bodies.
Next stop, Corpse Central.
The roamers had made it almost three-quarters of a mile farther, though whether they had been running from something or after something, it was impossible to say. The vultures and sand-dwelling insects had already made a feast of the tender parts of the dead, and peck marks and burrowed holes speckled their open flesh. While Bridget was busy examining the corpses, Grant and Kane paced around the area along with Descartes and the two scouts who had alerted them to their location. The scouts pointed out what they had noticed, and the three ex-mags evaluated everything they saw.
The sand's pitted and kicked up all over, like someone was wrestling.
The winds toss new sand over the area here and there, but it's still pretty clear that something happened here. If I saw this on one of my patrols without the corpses, I'd assume it had been a campsite the night before, and I'd be looking out for roamers.
What do you think happened?
Big prints around this way.
The ibis-masked incarnate pointed at tracks that led off to the north. Kane led the way, taking in the tracks to where they went over the horizon. The two tracks were side by side like footprints, deep indentations that had packed the sand tight. In some parts, the evidence had been covered by new sand, picked up by the wind, but there was enough evidence to assess the basic direction that their maker had taken.
Something big made these. That's a shoe size of...
He rested his forearm on the ground beside the track and saw that the print stretched almost the whole length from elbow to his second knuckle.
Massive.
There had been occasions where the Cerberus warriors had faced huge creatures, time-lost dinosaurs, vast mechanical monsters, and even ancient creatures whose size and endurance far outstripped that of man. Whatever had left these prints was not in that league, and yet it sent a disquieting shiver down Kane's spine as he considered the implications of the large footprints embedded in the sand. As the three ex-mags pondered the vast markings, Bridget and the medic walked over to join them.
You find anything, Bridget?
Nothing we hadn't already seen in the girl.
We have ourselves a set of tracks.
Grant pointed off into the distance where they led.
I'm guessing we follow them and see what shakes out of the trees.
Kane glanced up from his crouching position beside the closest print.
We bury the dead first.
While the others discussed their plan of action, Smarts got Rosalia's attention and indicated off to the side of the group while Domi's back was turned. Rosalia followed his gesture, masking the move as though trying to shield her eyes from the bright sun, and she saw the little carrying case for the interphaser left unguarded about 30 feet from the dead bodies and their attendant birds, resting on the floor of one of the open-top chariots. Silently, she turned to Smarts and shook her head just a fraction of an inch. Smarts assented with a long, heavy blink of his eyes, saying nothing. He trusted Rosalia. She would know when the time was right. As the group of solar-powered chariots traversed the sandy swells of the California desert, Kane engaged his contact and sent a call to the Cerberus Redoubt. He had left Domi guarding Smarts for this run, securing what little privacy he could for this conversation.
Kane to Cerberus. Come in, Cerberus.
This is Cerberus. How's everything going?
We're out in the desert now, and it's hot and getting hotter. Currently traveling in a northwesterly direction, following some deep footprints. Any chance you can scan the area up ahead of us, Bri?
Affirmative, Kane. It'll take a few minutes to get our eyes in position. I'll get back to you as soon as I can.
Cerberus controlled a Vela-class satellite. With it, Donald Bri could monitor the Earth from orbit with just a few instructions to his desktop computer. Kane glanced up at the rising sun, pulling the collar of the shadow suit away from his neck for a moment, as though to relieve himself of the increasing heat. In actuality, the shadow suit's artificial environment was keeping Kane and his team wonderfully cool, but there was something subliminal about being in the desert as the sun approached its midday zenith that made one feel too hot, Kane realized. It was the power of suggestion.
We'll be making a stopover shortly, Bri. Give everyone a chance to cool down some.
Understood. I'll get whatever information I can glean before you take off again.
Acknowledged.
Concealed within the rocky clefts of Montana's Bitterroot Mountain Range, tucked beneath camouflage netting, hidden uplinks chattered in their continuous electronic conversation with two orbiting satellites that provided the Cerberus Redoubt with a wealth of information about the outside world. Within the redoubt itself, a foreboding three-story structure of concrete and metal, hidden by the mountains, communications expert Donald Bri was studying their data feed on the screen of his computer terminal. A round-shouldered man of small stature, Bri wore a constant expression of consternation beneath his curly mop of unruly copper-colored hair. A long-serving and trusted member of the Cerberus team, Bri acted as lieutenant and apprentice, in all things technological at least, to Lakesh. Bri's computer was one of more than two dozen arranged in twin aisles inside the vast operations room of the military redoubt. The control center was the brains of the Cerberus operation, and the room was constantly manned by scientists and communications experts. A number of these staff members had come to Cerberus from cryogenic stasis in the Menetius moon base, and the redoubt could now boast some of the sharpest scientific and military minds of the late 20th century, time displaced and awakened to fill its swelling ranks. Back when it was first operational, Cerberus had been called Redoubt Bravo, adhering to the standard military convention of using the phonetic letter of the alphabet in naming. The huge complex had undergone a number of changes since then, but it still retained something of its original purposes to safeguard the freedom of humankind. As Bri scanned the feed from the Vela-class satellite's camera and thermal sensors, he was unaware that he was being watched by Lakesh. Though he looked to be a man of perhaps 50 years of age, Lakesh was in fact much older. Having spent over a century in cryogenic suspension, Lakesh was truthfully a man of 250 years, and until quite recently, he had looked to be exactly that. A contrivance of circumstances had seen a would-be ally of the Cerberus exiles court their favor by reversing the aging process and granting the physicist and cybernetics expert a new lease on life. Bri looked up from the screen as the satellite scanned the California desert for the coordinates that Kane's subcutaneous transponder was broadcasting. The transponders provided the Cerberus nerve center with a constant stream of information about a field operative's health and well-being, monitoring heart rate, blood pressure, and brainwave activity.
How's Kane?
Bri pointed to the screen as the satellite zeroed in on Kane's transponder.
Kane's squad is in Death Valley, chasing footprints in the sand. He's asked me to look ahead to try to clue them in on what's making those prints.
I see. That's quite close to where the quake hit, isn't it?
Bri turned in his swivel chair and pointed to the large Mercator relief map that spanned one whole wall of the ops room. The Mercator map included dozens of tiny lights, each indicating a point where a known operational MATRANS unit was located. A plethora of colored lines linked each of these lights, somewhat in the manner of an old-fashioned flight plan, showing the many connections between gateways. The map was a legacy of the time when the Cerberus Redoubt had been dedicated to the exploration of the viability and military application of a MATRANS system. Dominating the vast operations room, the map was a handy reference that the personnel often examined. Bry's extended finger traced along the west coast of North America, a coastline that had been remade by quakes in the past 200 years.
The quake struck a fault line that ran through Arizona and across into California, culminating somewhere out in the Pacific. Mariah says it topped 7 on the Richter scale, and estimates it went far beyond that before it had played out.
So Kane is definitely within the little pocket that it disturbed.
He is, but there's no reason to assume that there will be another quake anytime soon.
No, of course not, Donald. It was merely an observation.
Bry moved back to his terminal. He tracked ahead of Kane's team in the direction of the footprints that the man had described in his communique. As the satellite traced slowly along the area, he turned back to Lakesh, who was still studying the Mercator map, his thoughts his own.
If I may be so bold, when you make what you call a mere observation, it usually means you have something in mind.
Lakesh turned to Bry, an enigmatic smile playing across his lips.
In my long years, I have noticed one thing above all else. Coincidence is a very tricky thing.
Bry nodded knowingly before returning to the task of scanning the live satellite feed. Descartes' incarnates, the Cerberus warriors, and their prisoners rested in the lee of the outcropping as the blazing sun dawdled high overhead. While things were quiet, Kane took the opportunity to speak with Bridget and the rest of his allies.
Any thoughts, Baptiste?
I'll be honest and say I've never seen anything quite like it. The roamers, like that girl, appeared to have just burned up from within, as though struck by a massive surge of energy.
Grant nodded thoughtfully, looking from Bridget to Keb, the incarnate medic.
Could it be some kind of spontaneous combustion?
Keb and Bridget shook their heads doubtfully.
Now, this has the nature of a disease, or an infection of some sort. But like your companion, it is something the likes of which I have never witnessed before.
The fever that burns people from the inside. Is such a thing even possible?
The human body is capable of a great many things. Just because we haven't seen it before doesn't mean it's impossible.
How about calling in DeFore? Lakesh might even want to take a look.
We have no idea how this thing started, nor where. For now, let's keep the number of personnel who come into contact with it to a minimum.
You're just scared of what I'd do if Lakesh got hurt.
Maybe a little.
Off the top of my head, I'd go so far as to say that this is something not seen in medical dictionaries, which means it's something new, and we cannot discount the possibility that it has been intentionally unleashed.
You recall the details of every disease? That's beyond credibility.
That's what you think. Bridget has a memory that
can... It's okay, Domi. Look, I remember a lot, and seeing these symptoms didn't trigger any kind of recall.
Descartes shot the incarnate a warning look, urging the man to back down. Senor Smart sat beside Rosalia, his jacket hanging from a jagged part of the rock face, while she fanned at her face with long, languid strokes of one of the silks that made up the veils of her costume. The wispy costume itself was now strained from her dunking in the sea and muddied by the kicked-up sand of their passage, but it still clung to her curvaceous body enticingly. To fan herself, she had pulled away a strip that wrapped across her belly, leaving her midriff exposed. While the others were immersed in their discussion, Smarts reached into his pocket and withdrew the pocket cron. The clock face had cleared now, the condensation, evidence of its dunking in the tsunami, all gone. His dark eyes flicked up to assess his captors before he worked the winder. The compass and rangefinder took effect, and the hands on the dial spun as they gave a reading. Smarts smiled as he turned to Rosalia, as she rested against the cool, shady rock, waving her silk at her face to create a breeze.
We are just 9 miles from the camp.
Rosalia's eyes flashed to him, and a broad smile crossed her features.
That close? Which direction?
Smarts leaned back. Stretching his arms above his head, Rosalia watched carefully as his right arm pointed to the west.
There are markers as one gets closer. Things that will be missed by others.
She nodded once. The time was drawing near. As the Cerberus field team waited in the shade of the vast rocks, Kane's contact came to life.
Satellite surveillance isn't showing much, Kane. I've tracked along the basic direction you're heading in, northwest, but there's not much going on. Looks like a small settlement about 5 miles ahead of you, just a handful of shacks. Could be temporary.
Any people, Bry?
Some movement, but nothing struck me as out of the ordinary. No fires or signs of destruction. Just a normal little settlement. 5 small buildings, people eking out a living. Looks like a horse in a corral there, too.
Anything further?
I'm panning ahead now, continuing northwest, but it's hard to tell. I can't see the prints from this distance. Just can't get that kind of level of detail into the image. As far as I can see, I'm looking at sand on sand. So if your bogey has changed course, then I've lost him.
Pull back. See if anything else is out of the ordinary. Something as big and heavy as this shouldn't be that hard to miss.
I could lose it in a shadow, or it could be undercover, but I'll try my best.
Thanks, Bri.
Kane turned to everyone in the group, aware that Descartes and the Incarnates hadn't been privy to both sides of the discussion with Cerberus.
Our surveillance tells us there's a settlement about 5 miles up ahead. No signs of trouble, but it's right in the path of our mysterious quarry. I think it's worth checking out.
We're farther out than my men usually come, so any settlements out this way will be as new to us as they are to you.
Then let's all keep our eyes open and watch one another's backs.
Descartes looked across at the ragtag pair of street thieves as they waited patiently in the shade of the rocks.
What about your two friends? I predict they'll start flagging if we're going as far as this settlement.
We'll keep moving forward for now, and they'll have to keep up.
Why don't you just force them to give you the information?
If we put too much pressure on them, they'll only give us a false lead and rab it as soon as they see an opportunity.
Domi's hand stroked the hilt of the large knife she had strapped against her calf.
I could cut the information out of them. Bet the man would start speaking pretty soon once he started bleeding his own blood.
No. You have to understand these people. They lie and swindle for a living. No amount of pressure will change that in them. It's instinctive. But if they realize they're not going anywhere until they give us what they want, and they maybe see an opportunity to get something out of it in the process, they'll cave. Just give it time.
That's showing a lot of patience.
And a lot of faith in your skills at second-guessing people.
Well, if it comes to it, we'll use your way.
Mariah Falk sat at the computer in the Cerberus Redoubt, puzzling over the figures that were displayed before her. A very experienced geologist, Falk was a slender woman in her mid-40s with short brown hair streaked with gray. Though not especially attractive, she had an ingratiating smile that always put others at their ease. She sat at her desk, idly chewing at her pen as she tried to map out the readings. She was looking at a variety of data regarding the earthquake from 2 days before. Earthquakes, in fact. A half dozen in quick succession had rippled across the tectonic plates to the west of the old United States. The Cerberus operation was geared up for study in a number of fields, but acquiring accurate readings for an unexpected phenomenon like this was difficult. Mariah leaned forward in her seat, pulling a printout from the stack that sat in her in-tray and noting the peaks that the crazy logarithmic wave had hit when the quake rocked the California coast. She brought up a relief map of the western side of the continent of North America. If her data was correct, this quake had reached over 400 miles from the effects that had been felt by Kane and his teammates on the California coast. She fed the data into the computer simulation program and watched as concentric circles grew from a point about 100 miles north of Phoenix, Arizona. She switched the epicenter farther to the north, incorporating the limited data that she had amassed. Then she sat back and watched as the quake pattern was mapped.
Monstrous!
As she stared in astonishment at the computer screen, Clem Bryant strode up to her desk, carrying a tray with several covered dishes.
Oh, Clem, I didn't hear you.
Quite all right.
Clem was a quiet man in his late 30s, with dark hair swept back from a high forehead, a neatly trimmed goatee, and intelligent blue eyes. He was an expert in oceanography and had been part of the scientific brain trust that had been placed in suspended animation shortly before the nuke cost. However, upon his awakening at the Menetius moon base and relocation to Cerberus, he had found little application for his chosen discipline and had instead begun devoting a large amount of his time working in Cerberus Redoubt's canteen. Much to everyone's surprise, not the least his own, Bryant had turned out to be a natural chef. And he had thrown himself into this new discipline with gusto. He took great pride in his culinary creations, adding a personal touch, despite being called upon to feed more than 60 personnel per meal most days. Mariah cleared a space at her desk, and Clem set the tray down.
Thank you. I had planned to come up to the canteen.
An army marches on its stomach.
Clem gazed at the map on Mariah's terminal.
Plotting your empire?
Despite his easy manner and his diverse fields of expertise, Clem Bryant was very much a scientist at heart. In his quieter moments, he could be found hovering around the empty corners of the large canteen or the redoubt archives, working at a logic problem that he had found in an old book or newspaper, a mathematical question, a chess puzzle, or a crossword of the devious cryptic variety popular in Great Britain before the end of civilization early in the 21st century. In short, Clem Bryant was an obsessive thinker, and his insights had served the Cerberus personnel well over the past few months. Mariah pointed at the screen with her pen as Clem pulled over a spare chair to sit beside her.
If my estimates are correct, this quake was at least an 8 on the Richter scale.
That certainly sounds like a lot of quake.
It's almost unheard of. 8 was the level recorded for the infamous San Francisco quake of 1906. Factor in estimated levels on the Mercalli scale.
Huh?
The Mercalli scale registers the intensity of earthquake phenomena. It's subjective, based on observable levels. But with 6 or 7 quakes one after the other like this, we can safely assume it's pretty high.
Assume away while you eat.
Maria opened the bowl that Clem had brought.
Mmm.
And the rich smell of vegetable soup filled the office.
Oh, this is great.
That's very kind of you to say. But what about this whole Mercalli scale business?
If we could locate the epicenter of the first quake, we would find some very definite evidence of a whole change in the lay of the land. This is the sort of tremor that levels buildings and moves mountains, Clem.
And where is the epicenter?
Mariah pointed at the map.
Here, Humphreys Peak, Arizona.
Meaning?
I don't know yet, but I can't help worrying about what comes out of the woodwork when mountains get shaken so dramatically.